subtracting. I'm controlling and composing.
I'm the Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on WCOMLP, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, which, as you know, is one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And there is a website for the program, which you can find at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. You can access all of our past programs on the website, and it's getting to be very extensive archive on the wide variety of topics we've featured here on the show, so we hope you'll check it out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and you'll get right to the podcast site. And I have just confirmed that that is actually working like a charm. My guest today actually has done that, so that's a good thing. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well at communityradio.coop. I want to mention that Radio In Vivo and WCOM have benefited from the support of the multi-talented Claudio Oswald Niedvorak. Claudio is a master teller, storyteller, and a performing poet and author. Claudio is available for other bookings, so check out his website at www.claudioarts.com. And I should mention that Claudio is going to be one of our new DJs here on WCOM. His program is going to be starting next week, Tuesday mornings at 10 o'clock, so we hope you'll tune in for that. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the CIIT Centers for Health Research in Research Triangle Park. CIIT is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, CIIT has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank CIIT for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology, by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. Well, in recent weeks here on Radio In Vivo, we have explored a wide variety of scientific avenues, including Duke Forest and the future of information technology, and the Artificial Retina Initiative a couple of weeks ago. Today we return to two of our favorite topics, genomics and evolution. And we are with a gentleman who brings us expertise in both areas and how they interface and interact in the field known as evolutionary genomics. Dr. Greg Ray is the director of the Center for Evolutionary Genomics at Duke University, which is part of the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. Greg received his Ph.D. in biology from Duke in 1987, and he was assistant professor of ecology and evolution at the State University of New York at Stony Brook from 1993 to 99. He was the recipient of the Young Investigator Award in Evolutionary Biology from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation for his work in the evolutionary genetics of animal development. Greg has been an assistant professor of biology at Duke since 1999, and he is the author of more than 75 scholarly publications in his field. Greg, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Glad to be here.
Greg, to get us started, I'd like to explore some of the concepts you spoke about in a dual lecture you gave to the North Carolina State Science Teachers Association last year. The first talk was called Making Evolution Real and Relevant Using Medical and Genomic Examples. And then you spoke about evolution for everyone. Since evolution is such a commonly misunderstood branch of science, let's start there with the basics.
Sure.
What did you tell the science teachers to help them communicate evolution clearly and accurately to their students?
Well, Ernie, I think one of the challenges in teaching evolutionary biology is making it seem relevant and making it seem real. If you pick up any high school biology textbook, or for that matter, most college biology textbooks, and turn to the chapter on evolution, what you typically find are a bunch of engravings of 18th century pictures of ships and tortoises and the young Charles Darwin.
Right.
And it gives evolution a flavor of being something that was perhaps interesting during the Victorian era, but not really very important for our lives today. So one of my messages was really, let's see if we can make this something that your students can connect to and feel is real.
Sure, sure. Well, we've now sequenced more than 1,000 genomes, mm-hmm. including, of course, the human genome. Why are all of these animals' genomes being sequenced, and why is that so important?
Wow, that's a great question. So I think there's more than one motivation for sequencing genomes. There mm-hmm. are practical reasons. A lot of the genomes that have been sequenced are the genomes of pathogenic microorganisms that would give us diseases. And so sequencing those genomes is very important for understanding what makes them tick and how they do the things that they do to make us sick, how we can diagnose them, how we can treat those illnesses, how we can prevent those illnesses. That's one motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other genomes, obviously our own genome being sequenced, again, primary motivation being understanding our own health and disease states. Although we can talk, maybe we'll talk a little bit later about what that can tell us about human evolution.
Sure.
Another motivation is that has been quite important for the National Institutes of Health is that by sequencing a lot of mammal genomes, we have a sense of what sort of a generic mammalian genome looks like. And then what we know about our own genome stands out in contrast and helps us understand what uniquely genetic features of humans make their traits uniquely different. So that's another motivation. You could say that's evolution in the service of medical understanding. And then there's the pure science part of it. We'd like to know the genetic basis for this wonderful diversity of life on the planet we live on.
Absolutely. Well, let's go right to the where does genomics and evolution, what is the interface there? How do these two fields connect to form your field, mm-hmm. evolutionary genomics?
So part of the answer to that question is we're still figuring that out. This is a new fusion. Genomics itself as a discipline really doesn't go back that far. It essentially dates to the time that we could start sequencing entire genomes, which is really not that long ago. And of course, the discipline of evolutionary biology has been around for a very long time. So it made sense that if we want to understand how life on Earth evolved and how, for instance, we got to be distinctive as a species, that we would tap into that new expanded base of knowledge and the approaches that people take to study genomics.
I see. Well, is this all a way of giving us the ability to look backward and forward at the same time, not only giving us the insight into human health and disease that you talked about, but mm-hmm. but shedding new light on our evolutionary background as well?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think one of the great things about the Human Genome Project is that even though it was, the primary motivation was a health motivation, all kinds of other interesting things have come out of it. This is similar to what happened when NASA made the moonshots.
Sure.
We got Velcro, we got Tang. We could argue about whether all of those things are necessarily good, but these were so-called spin-offs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the really interesting things that's been able to watch happen over the past couple of years is that there have been enormous scientific dividends that have been spin-offs of the Human Genome Project. And one of the really, really interesting ones is that, of course, it gives us a lot of insight into how we got to be what we are, distinctive, unique species of primates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and not to mention all the new tools and informational tools.
Absolutely. I mean, along with, because this is a scale of information that we never dealt with before as scientists, there had to be technology developed to gather that information, automated sequencing machines, ways of looking at gene expression across the whole genome, and then also computationally. We had to be able to understand how to think about data on a scale that was orders of magnitude larger than we'd ever dealt with before. And this has been a very interesting process. It's drawn in statisticians and computational scientists and mathematicians who have the tools to look at those kinds of data that biologists, quite frankly, until recently, have not been trained in.
Right. Well, it's almost like it's enforced the need for a multidisciplinary approach, which is so in vogue at this point.
You're so right. I mean, it's in vogue because it's the only way to go forward right now. It is a time when a lot of science is being done by people who come from disparate backgrounds because no one's got the full skill set to look at these kinds of data sets and think about what they mean, to gather the data and so forth. It's a very exciting time. Yeah.
So has that made the type of work you do easier in a way, or more challenging in a way, or both? Some of both.
It is some of both. I mean, the challenges are primarily learning to talk to somebody who has a different vocabulary. So we do find that we spend a lot of time sitting down, having a cup of coffee, and trying to figure out what we mean when we say something, and also what's possible. What a statistician would like to see in an ideal data set may be hard for us to deliver for technical reasons, and what we would like them to extract from our data set, there may be statistical issues that we're not aware of as bench scientists that a statistician can tell us about. So it's a mutual education process.
Yeah. I see. Let's go back to talk about evolution a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think many people think, and you alluded to this, that evolution is something that happened a long, long time ago.
Right.
If they believe in it at all,
right.
Of course, which
right.
is a whole another kettle of fish.
Right.
But of course, as we can readily see in the ongoing battle between the microbial world and our ability to fight disease with antibiotics, as one good example, evolution is actually happening constantly,
mm-hmm.
and can happen quite rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Are human beings still evolving as well? Are our genomes responding to evolutionary pressures?
Great question, and let's pick that apart a little bit.
Okay,
time.
Please do.
So
we got plenty of time.
Yeah, let's start with the microbes. I mean, it is true that I think a lot of people who would have trouble, let's say, believing that evolution produces whole new species are comfortable with the notion that resistance evolves. Bacterial resistance to antibiotics, for instance, or insects become resistant to pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, is a concept that's fairly well believed and understood by the lay public.
And that is an example of evolution.
It's certainly an example of evolution in action. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a negative example, if you will, because it's a place where, because of evolution, we have an economic and societal problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I like to do is stress that just as evolution works for the microbes, it actually works for us too. And maybe I could give you an example of humans evolving that gets to the second part of your question.
Please do.
So during the process of becoming human, a lot of things changed about our lives, our societal interactions, our reproductive physiology, our diet has changed a lot. And we can see how our genomes responded to those changes and adaptive changes that have happened, just as we can in bacteria. So an example that I personally have worked on is the phenomenon of being able to digest milk as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you come from European background or East African background, you can probably do this. But there are a lot of people, for instance, many people who have East Asian ancestry, that can't digest milk as an adult. And in fact, that's true for most mammals. That's the typical situation.
Hmm.
The ability to digest milk evolved very recently, really just in about the last 10,000 years. And it's very closely associated with societies that had cattle.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
it is an example of a trait. We now know the precise genetic basis for it. It's the smallest mutation you can get, one base changing into another. And bingo, you can digest milk as an adult. And the interesting thing is this has evolved more than once, the same trait, because there's more than one mutation that can give you that capability. And so East African populations had one mutation that gave them this ability, and European populations had a different mutation. That's evolution in action. It happened very recently. It's now almost universal in European populations.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a quick change in response to a useful trait.
Sure, but of course we all know people who perhaps lack that mutation. I have one child who is lactose intolerant.
It's not uncommon. Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
That's fascinating. So mm-hmm. within the last 10,000 years.
And again, very closely.
Which in evolutionary terms is a blink of the eye.
Is a blink of that, particularly when you consider human generations are, you know, more than a decade, certainly, depending on exactly, but it's going to be 1 to 3 decades between mm-hmm. generations. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting. Greg, as more and more species genomic sequences are completed, and I do want to get into the specifics of your work a little bit later, is the gain in knowledge exponential? I mean, are we constantly learning more and more, almost mirroring the gain in the computer world in terms of storage and data and things like that?
Wow, that is a great question. So I have two minds about this.
Okay.
At one level, in terms of simply kind of getting our heads around what the content of a genome is, you know, how many genes are they, what do they do, how are they organized, we kind of have that figured out now for mammals. We have it figured out for insects. We have that figured out for major crop plants and so forth. And so you might say, oh, well, why sequence any more genomes? We kind of get it now. The reason that that's probably not really true is that the more genomes we sequence, excuse me, Ernie,
sure,
the more we learn about, we can identify the specific features of a genome that endow a particular species with unique traits. So if we want to know why human cognitive capabilities are different from those of chimpanzees, for instance, we need to have the human genome, the chimpanzee genome, and actually beneficially a lot more primates, so we can really see what stands out as being the unique traits. In the bacterial world, it's even more interesting, because every time a new bacterial genome is sequenced, we find genes that none of the other bacteria contained. And this is really remarkable, because for bacteria, what you can digest essentially is who you are. And so there's an enormous diversity of physiological capabilities that are just out there that we're really probably just scratching the surface. So we're not maxing out yet, and mm-hmm. it is mm-hmm. kind of exponential, in that every new piece of information helps us understand pieces of information we already had.
Right, yeah. right. Well, I mean, it seems like when you talk about the bacterial world, it seems like the potentials there are limitless, practically.
They are. There's almost no place a bacterium can't grow. So, you know, utilizing a resource, being able to break down a toxin, being able to function at high temperature, low temperature, high salinity, all of these things can potentially lead to pharmacological compounds or biotechnology approaches that would otherwise be very, very difficult for us to come up with on our own. Again, it's sort of evolution's done the work for us. We just walk in and take advantage of it. So,
right. Yeah. And we certainly see applications of that even now in, you know, cleaning up oil spills and toxic
Absolutely.
Waste and things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Okay. Well, as I mentioned in my introduction, Greg, you specialize in the study of the evolutionary genetics of animal development.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly want to find out all about that. But before we drill down into the specifics of your work, tell us a little bit more about what that field is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was really motivated by, we call this sometimes for short, Evo-Devo, and that's shorthand for evolution of development.
As in, we are Evo-Devo?
We are Evo-Devo, yeah. Right. That term did have some, there was a certain band in the 80s that influenced the, anyway. So Evo-Devo, the idea there is to connect two threads of evolutionary biology that had not really been tightly integrated before. The older thread is the one that began with Darwin, which is thinking about traits evolving in organisms over time. This is something we can observe, and we can see that species are different and individuals differ.
And at this point, given the history, those concepts are pretty firmly well understood.
Those concepts are well understood, but we have a kind of an open question as to how it all came about. We understand the process. Mm-hmm. Natural selection and a variety of other processes produce biological diversity. The other thread is one based on genetics. And you can think of it sort of as the genetic complement to this, looking at genes and gene sequences over time. Until very recently, those two traditions both very robust and intellectually vibrant traditions operated kind of independently, which is surprising if you think about it. Mm-hmm. What Evo Devo
tries... Because at the genomic level, that's where it's happening,
that's
right?
Where it's happening. And a lot of people, all they do in their work is to look at, I mean, all in a negative context, but that is the focus of their work, is just to look at the DNA sequences. Mm-hmm. What Evo Devo came along and said, look, there's genes are evolving, traits are evolving, let's figure out how one gets turned into the other. So development, speaking broadly, is just how you turn a genome into an organism. It's the process of developing out of a single cell into, you know, in our case, billions of cells. And how do you get there? And how do changes in one's genetic makeup affect that process? Because that affects what we look like and how we function and who we are.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So in scientific terms, it's really the quest to link genotype to so-called phenotype.
That's precisely right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's certainly a lot of
there's
work
a lot
there.
In there. Yeah, it has for a long time been treated effectively as a black box. I mean, we know there is a connection. That's not so that's it's not that we're trying to show that there's a connection, but more to the point, to understand how that process unfolds, and how a single small change in the genome can percolate up to the point where it has a trait, has a consequence, as a trait that we can see and measure. So.
And of course, it's more complicated than just the initial genome itself, because there are effects that happen, so-called epigenetics, right?
There are so many complexities, and one of your earlier guests, Dr. Greg Gibson, talked a lot about what he calls complex traits. These are traits that, more than one gene affects the trait. Your experience, in other words, the environment affects it.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother's physiology even can affect it, and that's sort of an epigenetic phenomenon where her status gets passed on to you. There are all kinds of wrinkles in this process that make it, let's just say, it's not trivial to sort of understand. And so picking
sure.
those apart is itself an entire enterprise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, my guest on Radio In Vivo this morning is Dr. Greg Ray, who is director of the Center for Evolutionary Genomics at Duke University, and we are talking all about evolutionary genomics. Greg, the types of findings you get when you study the evolutionary genetics of the development mm-hmm. of species such as the purple sea urchin, which we will hear all about, yeast, ants, and baboons, how applicable are those types of findings mm-hmm. to humans?
They're quite applicable. One of the really interesting things that came out of the past decade and a half of research and the birth of genomics and getting into real genomics like we're doing today, one of the really cool things that came out of that is an understanding that essentially the genetic makeup of organisms is, to a first approximation, more similar than we thought.
Right.
So the genes that control development in us and in a fruit fly are really, really similar. It turns out to be as much how they interact with each other as what the genes are that determine what you end up getting out of development. So that was a really exciting finding. It just changed the way we think about evolution, the way we think about development. And that revolution basically happened during the 1990s. And now we're trying to figure out how to go forward. And we know what the answer sort of is. It's that the way you make new traits is you rewire, so to speak, the way that genes interact with each other. And that's what we need to now figure out.
And with the environment.
And that's so important. And that is has probably until recently been a little underappreciated by more the developmental biology community. Not so the evolutionary biologists have sort of been aware of this for a long time. Mm-hmm. But again, this is where Evo Devo is sort of stepping into the breach and trying to bridge that gap between an understanding in one community of scientists and an understanding from another community of scientists.
Mm-hmm. Well, the conference we were talking about earlier that's mm-hmm. coming up at NESANT mm-hmm. At the end of this month mm-hmm. Is looking at exactly that.
That's right.
The blending of evolutionary study and medicine
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how the two fields can interact to the benefit of both.
Yes.
Yeah. Is the conservation of genomic characteristics sufficient among all these different species, all the ones you study, and you know there are hundreds of thousands of other ones, is there enough conservation there to give us important information about human evolutionary development?
Yeah, no, so that's a great question. So the hope, of course, is that yes. I mean, that's what we're aiming toward. And so, but we have real limitations in studying human beings. We can't do things with them in the lab, obviously, that we would do with a fruit fly.
Can't slice their brains open.
We can't slice their brains open while they're alive and
while
so forth.
Alive, right.
Yeah, and so obviously there are some for perfectly.
Or you're not supposed to.
Or not, for perfectly good ethical and moral and practical reasons, we don't want to do that. So yet we would like to understand what makes our bodies tick. And again, in an abstract sense, we'd like to understand where we came from. So to get at those questions, we have to turn to these so-called model systems. And fruit flies and mice are commonly studied. One of the things that's come out of looking at a diversity of organisms, again, is getting the sense for what the universals are. If there's something that goes on in a fruit fly and a mouse embryo, there's a pretty good chance that that kind of process is happening in a human embryo, even though we are not going to go in and directly measure it ourselves. So this is, again, where evolutionary comparisons can come in and help us understand something that we're not going to be able to understand otherwise. Now, it's not perfect knowledge because, of course, a fruit fly embryo and a mouse embryo aren't identical. They would end up making the same thing if they were.
Sure.
But there are some universals about the genetic basis for development, and those are very, very powerful kinds of understandings because we can apply them to understanding human development and human health and disease.
Mm-hmm. So to a certain extent, the basic networks and mechanisms that you seek to elucidate are similar in many, if not all, forms of life.
There are universals. Of course, there are things that are different. Mm-hmm. And again, the more
that's telling as well.
That's telling as well, and that's where it becomes really an interesting evolutionary question. You know, how much does it take to make a fruit fly look different from a mosquito? Well, and some people would rather we just got rid of the mosquitoes than answer that question. But there they are, and we'll talk more about
mosquitoes later. I have a okay. mosquito question. For
okay,
you.
Great. Well, we have now a couple fruit fly genomes completely sequenced, and we have two mosquito genomes sequenced. So what can you do now? Well, you can go in and say what is mosquito-ness in the genome and what is flyness, and they're actually pretty closely related. So differences that parse out to one or the other of those groups become candidate regions of the genome for us to go look at experimentally and further refine our understanding of how they become different evolutionarily.
So it's the commonalities and the differences.
Absolutely. And that's, again, that gets back to your question, is this an exponential growth of information? When you start doing that kind of comparison, that's when it really gets to be exponential, because the more information you have, the better you can parse out the difference between the commonalities and the universal and the distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you it sounds like there's so much opportunity for learning right now. Do you have enough people coming into the field?
A lot of people are coming into this field right now. So you can always tell where the interesting scientific questions are by where the new graduate students and undergraduates go to do their work and the kinds of questions they want to, because they're really interested in looking ahead and figuring out what the exciting new opportunities are. And so they're, in a sense, they're the canaries, and mm-hmm. they're telling us that yep, they're voting with their feet. There are a lot of people moving into this area. And as an old guy who's, come to this as it's happened, it's been very exciting for me because I can see the contrast to how really in the dark we were 20 years ago when I was doing this kind of work initially. And now the amount of analytical and information power we can bring to bear on these questions is just astonishing.
Well, and growing all the time, too.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it seems like, there was a lot of talk when the Human Genome Project was completed, the mm-hmm. sequence was completed. What's next? What right. is this buying us, for the, yeah. all these billions of dollars that have mm-hmm. been invested?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like perhaps we are on the cusp of actually getting the real huge returns on that investment.
That is so true. I mean, I think if you look at what's come out of the Human Genome Project, we're still only beginning to tap into that. So to evaluate its impact at this point is clearly premature. The reason, it's kind of interesting why it's taken a while to get our heads around this, but if you think about this, DNA is just, it's just four letters. GACT. And mm-hmm. if you look at a string of DNA, there's nothing that leaps out of it at you that says, oh, hi, here, I'm a gene, I cause cancer, or something like that. Mm-hmm. You have to figure mm-hmm. that out. And so what the Human Genome Project has done is given us a complete parts list, if it were. And now we can go in and try and associate those parts with particular traits and interactions among those parts with particular traits and breaking of those interactions with disease states. And that takes a lot of time, but we couldn't have done that if we didn't know what we're dealing with. So that's why it's taking some time, but we're just beginning to see the fruits of that work. It was probably dollar for dollar the best scientific investment that anybody's ever made.
Wow, yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly not that long ago that, we recall that it was front page news.
Absolutely.
When a gene for a particular condition, breast cancer, whatever, was isolated.
Yep.
And that was the product of years of intensive research.
Yeah, and what we can do now is if we can, a physician who does a study and can map a trait to a particular region of the genome can now go to the Human Genome Project and say, what genes are in that region? And what's the most likely, what looks like it's the likely one that's causing the problem? And it can focus attention far more rapidly than the old days, where it was more or less hunt and peck, trial and error. And so the time between doing a clinical study and finding the genetic basis for the trait has been cut enormously.
Yeah. And the ability to, as you discussed a moment ago, isolate the genetic component of complex traits, obviously, many of the complex traits and diseases, and even what color our hair is and things like that, involve thousands of genes.
Yeah, many genes. It's hard for us to measure. The more there are, the harder it is for us to pick the ones out of the forest to find those trees in the forest. Mm-hmm. And so, what we usually hope is that there's going to be a few that stand out as having a bigger impact than the others.
I see.
We get a hold of those. We sort of figure out there, and then you can go back and look at the data again and kind of screen those out and find the next most important ones. And that's a process that takes time, but eventually we can tease out quite a lot of information. Yeah.
Now, the types of findings we're talking about, and the types of findings that you come up with in your work about developmental networks and the mechanisms involved, are these potentially translatable to human health and disease?
They are.
Or our understanding of human development.
Absolutely. I mean, human development, again, we have to study mostly by proxy. Be looking at mouse embryos. There are a few studies that have looked directly at how genes function in embryos, but they're obviously going to be few and far between.
Sure.
So I'll give you an example of a case where there's a gene that we've studied quite a bit called prodynorphin. It makes a signaling molecule that gets used in your brain. It helps different neurons talk to each other, and it's been known for quite some time that some forms of schizophrenia and bipolar syndrome map to this region, implicating this gene as a possible cause. Now, there are a number of variants of this gene, and trying to figure out which one causes the disease states is difficult, because these are complex traits. They're partly determined by the environment, so it's all the difficulties one has doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Attention has focused on one particular variant as being causal in these neurocognitive diseases.
Now, is that causal or increasing risk?
These are risk, so they're not directly causal in the sense of deterministic, but they are increasing risk, but they're causal in the sense of that we think we understand biochemically why a defect in this gene would lead to that disease state. But it's not a sort of guarantee. You can have a particular genotype and not have the disease because the environment has a big impact and because other genes in your makeup affect it too.
Sure.
So this region, as I say, has been implicated, and this one variant has been the focus of a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've done is we've gone back in time evolutionarily and looked at the totality of genetic variation in human populations and compared this to other great apes and narrowed down the range of what the other possibilities might be that one would need to look at. And we've now expanded the list of variants that clinicians can use when they go do their genetic trials. So instead of one variant to look at, now there are three or four additional variants. And by knowing which ones to pay attention to and which ones they can safely ignore, we've helped put a tool back in the hands of the clinicians that's come out of, again, out of the basic research in evolutionary biology. So it's a process that goes back and forth. We learn from the physicians, then we go do some things, and occasionally we're able to hand them back something that gives them some additional power.
I see. So how does understanding the evolutionary changes in interactions between these developmental regulatory genes we're discussing and their downstream targets, how will understanding those types of things in simple creatures like the sea urchin, how does that filter in?
Oh, that's such a great question, Ernie. What we need to know is how those switches are thrown during development. As you say, certain genes interact with what we call downstream target genes. That means that one gene influences how another gene functions. Mm-hmm. We tend to study that interaction in the form of regulating expression. So the upstream gene, so-called, is turning on or off the downstream gene, usually in a special context, like only in one cell type or only in a certain condition, like after you've eaten or when you're sick or something like that. There's a lot of such interactions that occur. Now, again, this goes back to the idea of model organisms let you do things that you can study rapidly, inexpensively, and then you hope to gain insight, again, back into the human situation. So sea urchins, we can raise embryos of sea urchins. Nobody's going to be upset about that. We can put them on the benchtop. We can put them in Petri dishes. They're easy to rear. They're cheap, too, so studying them's not expensive. And we can study how these interactions unfold during development, how the genes talk to each other, how they regulate each other's expression. And from that, we hope to gain some general insights into how this process actually works, so that if we look at those same kinds of interactions in a disease state or in the context of human evolution, we already know what to look for. We can narrow down the range of possibilities, and we can design our experiments to be more efficient and incisive than just, again, than just sort of blundering around.
Yeah. Now, in models like the sea urchin, are you able to do things like knockout genes and do that those types of studies?
Yeah, so we are, and it's interesting. Back in the old days, which were not so long ago, you had to use genetics to do that. You had to create mutations, screen for the mutations in the gene you're interested in, et cetera, et cetera. We can now do exactly what you're saying. We can knock out using molecular tools and selectively eliminate the function of one gene, and then look at the rest of the network and say, if I pull this guy out, what happens? It's a little bit like...
Are you using gene silencing?
We are using gene silencing. There's a couple ways to do that. In the urchins, we use a method that essentially shuts down the production of the protein. And it's a very efficient methodology, and it works even for genes that are expressed at very high levels. So it's a good tool. It's not perfect, like most scientific tools. It has its limitations, but it's also quite powerful.
Just won the Nobel Prize, though.
That's correct. It was a Nobel Prize recently. Yes.
Well, Greg, I was fascinated to see that your group made a significant discovery concerning the great white shark. Everybody's favorite villainous creature. Could you sketch that out for us? What does Jaws have to tell us?
Yeah, what does Jaws have to tell us? So this is one of the great things about being a teacher. This project came out of an undergraduate who took a course with me and became interested. He was always interested in sharks and became interested in thinking about where the great white shark came from and what its relatives were. And North Carolina, you may or may not know, is a great place for fossil hunting. And if you go down on the coastal plain, there are places where you can pick up shark's teeth all over the place.
Sure.
And one of the teeth that you'll find, if you're lucky, is from a creature called Megalodon. And this thing was the gigantic shark. Its teeth are bigger than your hand. The jaws that you walk through when you go to the museum in Raleigh. Megalodon. So this is a kind of a legendary creature. It didn't live that long ago. So the assumption has always been that the Megalodon was the close relative, if not the ancestor, of the great white. And so he wanted to test that idea. And so he did a lot of fossil collecting. He went to museums. And we did a lot of very careful measurements of tooth shape, because that's what you find for shark fossils. You don't find the skeleton because it's all cartilage.
Sure.
And what he showed was that the conventional wisdom was wrong, that the great white is actually a mako. It's actually a mako shark and not from the megalodon. So there are a lot of shark aficionados who aren't too happy to hear that, because they kind of like the idea that the Meg was the ancestor of the great white. But that's in a nutshell the story. So.
Well, the truth is now out, and they'll have to live with it.
That's right.
Greg, you've also made several significant discoveries about the relationships in humans between genotype and phenotype, and you've mm-hmm. already gone into some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get your thumbnail sketches about some of the other ones, because it's, mm-hmm. it's such fascinating material.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we start with your finding about a genetic variation that seems to make heart disease mm-hmm. more prevalent among Europeans, if I read
right.
the material
so this,
correctly.
Yeah, it's a slightly complicated story. Normally, we think of a gene that has that gives a predisposition to a disease state as having a good copy and a bad copy,
mm-hmm.
and that if you have two versions, we have two versions of most genes. If you have two good copies, that's great. If you have one good, one bad, maybe not so good. And if you have two bad copies, you're at risk for some kind of a disease.
Yeah, Alzheimer's being a
great example. There are risk factors yeah. for high cholesterol, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So there are many such cases now known. Now, the interesting thing about this particular gene is that neither version is absolutely better under all circumstances. So it looks like one version is better if you have a high-fat diet, and another version might be better if you have a lower-fat diet. Which version you have depends, and whether it's good or bad, to some extent depends on how you live your life. And it also, of course, depends on the rest of your genetic makeup and so forth. But the interesting thing about this story was that it looks like the bad version has been under selection to become more prevalent. And you think, well, why would that be the case? Why would the version that predisposes you to illness be the one that's increasing? And the answer is, it only predisposes you to illness in the context of a modern diet. And so, you know, the mystery is again, it gets back to this notion that the environment influences gene activity and gene function. So sometimes the story's not so simple. But again, by placing this into a context of not just looking at people of European ancestry, because they sort of tell you one story. If you look at people who live in other climates, who have different diets, then you can begin to see how the pattern parses out. And you can say, okay, what's really interesting is that Europe stands out as being distinctive from the other populations that we looked at, and all those other populations are equatorial. They were never glaciated, and so the diet never shifted to one of these really high-fat diets like Europe was experiencing, people living in Europe were experiencing during the last ice age.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm.
So let me make sure I understand you correctly. The selection that has resulted in the so-called bad gene mm-hmm. being preferred and proliferating more, Why has that happened in spite of the high-fat diet? Why has that selection not taken
right.
care of that?
So it does take care of the high-fat diet. It just gives you a higher risk for another kind of heart disease.
I see.
So you can kind of pick your poison on this one. if the focus is on studying plaque buildup, which is what the original studies were done, you want one version, which is the one that's gone up in frequency in Europe, because it deals with high-fat diets well. On the other hand, it increases the chances of a different kind of heart disease, but that wasn't part of the original studies. That later did become clear, but what made it sort of fit together as a package was understanding that this was a unique situation in people of European ancestry,
mm-hmm.
probably
mm-hmm.
because their diets were quite distinctive. We also know, I should just interject, this is another example of a very recent evolutionary change, because this has happened in the last 20 to 30,000 years, essentially during the time that the glaciers were retreating and present mm-hmm. and retreating in northern Europe. So.
And the environment changed and diet and nutrition changed.
Absolutely. So selection's always a moving target.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that was actually my next question about mm-hmm. that, was that it really is an instance of natural selection among the human population.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
And in a relatively short period
of time. In a relatively short period of time, yeah, yeah.
So one has to wonder, what are human beings going to look like in another 10,000 years?
Well, that's a great question, and this comes up from time to time, probably not exactly the way we look like right now. Mm-hmm. A lot of what happens during the course of evolution is not something that's manifest in appearance, though. So there may be some changes in appearance. People have speculated we'll become less hairy. There may be some other changes like that happen. But a lot of the changes will be ones that we don't see. They'll affect the way our immune systems function, the way our physiology functions. And those sorts of changes are sort of happening under the hood, so to speak. They're very, very important. It's a sort of the locus of a lot of evolutionary change, but not so much in terms of our appearance, probably.
Sure. So it won't matter so much what we look like as what's on the inside going on.
Yeah.
And one has to wonder, will we also continue to evolve in terms of cognition?
This question comes up a lot, and my guess is that we probably will, because there's a lot of speculation as to why our brains got so big to begin with, but there's no question that having a big brain is really, really useful, and it's useful in a very generalized sense, in the sense of being smart, being able to think through problems and solve puzzles is what you would call a trait that has a wide applicability. And so it's not as if it's constrained to a certain niche or a certain kind of condition. It's just good overall to have good cognitive capabilities, good memory, so forth. So
I agree on my good days.
Yeah, I know. So I think the answer is that's not going to go away. Yeah.
Okay. Greg, there's another study I was reading about that I would like you to describe. You say on your website that you estimated that the average human is heterozygous for variants that affect transcriptional regulation at over 40% of all loci.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a lot of arcane
jargon. Well, let's unpack that.
It sounds very important.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that for us?
Sure. I mean, when people think about what is the cause of a genetic disease or what is the reason why two species look different, they're kind of asking the same question. Can we identify the genetic basis for trait differences? When scientists try and address that kind of question, usually they go looking at genes, which makes a lot of sense, right? You ignore the part of the genome that's not a gene,
mm-hmm.
and you look for things that affect the structure of the protein that comes out of that gene. So it has a different amino acid sequence, it'll function differently.
Sure.
What we really wanted to focus attention on was, and you could think of that sort of as the hardware that the genome produces little machines, we call them enzymes and proteins, and they go do things. We were kind of interested in the software part, which is what regulates the conditions under which that gene is expressed and therefore carries out its function.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were looking at the non-coding sequences. This is not the genes themselves, but the associated sequences that determine how much of that you produce, under what conditions, does the environment influence it, is it only in certain cell types, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, are these regions that used to be thought of as junk?
Exactly. So the term junk DNA became fashionable as sort of, we know that a large fraction of the human genome is not a gene. And the question is it completely functionless or is some of it functional? And we now know that the answer for sure is that a lot of it has function, and that function tends to be in regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets back to this notion that genes interact with each other, and this is one of the ways those interactions are mediated. So it's functional, but it's not literally speaking or strictly speaking a gene. So the point of the article that you were just quoting from was that there's a lot of variation in humans, you know, that you and I differ from each other in the way we regulate our genes, and that's raw material for natural selection to work with. If turning one gene up or down a little bit gives you a better chance of feeling better when you get the flu, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, that's raw material for selection to operate on. And so the point is just that there's a lot of functional variation out there for natural selection to play with in terms of gene regulation.
I see. But it seems very significant that you found that
so
40% of it is the same in everybody. Is that correct?
There are functions a two-sided sword. You want to have things work well in biology, because if they don't do their job, then that creates problems. But you don't want to have everything identical, because if there's no genetic variation, then when a new disease comes in or the climate changes, everybody's adapted for the old state.
And suddenly you're extinct.
You're extinct, exactly. So evolution is a mix between maintaining good function and opening the door to future opportunity. And so what we found is that there's both. I mean, there are genes that are probably regulated very, very tightly because to do anything else would be to create a functional problem. Mm-hmm. Yet there is some scope for, there's some wiggle room. And that wiggle room, as I say, is essentially the raw material that selection can operate on should conditions change.
I see, yeah. I see. Well, Greg, you are also tackling one of the very big questions. The source of the distinction between humans and the great apes in terms of cognition, anatomy, and physiology. And it looks like you've found some answers there.
Well, we're starting to. We have a better idea of where to look than we used to because of all these genome projects that have been done. And the challenge really is that we have to go in and use indirect methods to tease this apart because, again, we're not going to be able to do experiments with humans and say, oh, let's knock this gene out and see what happens.
Right.
So we work with a variety of indirect approaches. We can use statistics to help us identify where selection has occurred in the genome, and we do some of that. We can test gene function in tissue culture cells, and that lets us say, oh, well, the mutations that have occurred here, this is what they do at a functional level. And then finally, we can take advantage of clinical studies to ask what that variant does in a healthy human being. Does it make them taller? Does it make them better at evading certain kinds of pathogens? And so by drawing on these three threads, we can put together a picture that is not perfect, because again, we can't do the critical experiments, but it's far better than we used to have. And so now we know certain genes have been involved in, for instance, the evolution of cognition. And that's a very exciting thing to be able to look at.
Right. And so are you going to continue to be studying that very important question?
We will. And I can't tell you where we're going to go with this because it's very much sort of what we're doing right now. But what I can say for sure is that the opportunities there are far, far more exciting I think we've really got a great shot, not just me, I mean, I'm speaking about the scientific community at large,
sure,
of being able to come up with a much clearer understanding of where things like self-awareness, language, I mean, these are the big enchiladas of thinking about human evolution. You know, where did these things come from? How many genes were evolved? When did those changes happen?
Mm-hmm.
And how did they come about?
Again, very, very big questions.
Yes. And not ones we'll solve in the next year. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was going to hold you to a calendar. Greg, what are your thoughts when you, as I'm sure you do from time to time, take a step back from this very demanding, complex scientific work that you're involved with, to consider the wider implications of your studies? Are we approaching a day, as you've just kind of been alluding to, when science will be able to tell us pretty precisely what it is that makes a human being a human being?
Science will be part of answering that question. There's clearly dimensions to that question that are cultural, that are spiritual, that are really where science has a hard time going and doesn't go. And so, yeah, it'll be part of the understanding. I mean, I think one thing that science has taught us is that we are part of the natural world, I mean, in a physical sense.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're part of the natural world in a spiritual sense is something that science is not equipped to answer. And so, yeah, part of the answer will come from science, and it will be a story about our history, a much richer story than we currently have. And I think that'll be satisfying and undoubtedly interesting to know more about. Yeah.
So do you think it's all a good thing, or are there ethical and social implications that maybe need to be debated?
I think there definitely are. I mean, I think it's one of the most important things for scientists to consider when they do work in this area is how they communicate their results to the public and how they phrase these things, because it's very easy to say something like, we discovered the gene for intelligence. Now, there's no such thing as a gene for intelligence. Intelligence is the product of many factors, some of which are genetic, some of which, of course, are environmental.
Mm-hmm.
And what we can hope to do is learn about changes in gene function that have influenced our cognitive capabilities. But by its very nature, cognition is a very fluid and flexible thing, and we're not going to have a recipe for how to make a human brain with A, C's, T's, and G's.
Oh, good. So, we can rest easy on that one.
I think so, at least for a good while.
That's still in the realm of science fiction.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, Greg, tell us, let's go back to the practical a little bit. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the center that you direct at Duke, the Center for Evolutionary Genomics. How many investigators do you have, and what other types of projects are being conducted there?
Sure, yeah. So the Center for Evolutionary Genomics, really my brief as the director for that center is to foster good science. And so I see that in some sense as a kind of a combination between being a matchmaker and a cheerleader, try and get people interested in these kinds of questions, and then make sure they have the tools to do the research they want to do. Do we have the computers? Do we have the sequencers? And then partly it's someone who says, gee, I know how to sequence, but I don't know how to think about how to analyze these big data sets. So part of it's also, as I say, the matchmaker, getting mm-hmm. people who can work together across the table and helping them get started on their projects. So it's meant to be catalytic. It's meant to provide some intellectual direction, in the sense that we're hoping to identify interesting problems that where we can draw collaborators in and help us. And ideally, they'll spin off and do their own interesting projects. So it's really fun to do that, because it does allow me to step back a little bit away from my own research and think about what's happening in the broader scientific community.
Mm-hmm. And as part of the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy, do you and your faculty at the center participate in some of those, mm-hmm. The Institute's activities regarding policy and ethical considerations?
We do, and I think this is one of the really great things about the Institute, because its director, Dr. Hunt Willard, has really taken his
I very much want to get on the show.
You've got to get him on the show. Yeah. He's taken this as a very much as an interdisciplinary activity, where having people from the law school, the philosophers, and medical people, basic scientists, all get together and bring their distinctive perspectives. And it's really been a tremendous educational experience for me, because it's the only time I've been to a talk where you have people from business school, law school, surgeons, philosophers, poets, and computational biologists all sitting around talking about a set of issues of common interest. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, that does sound fantastic. Well, Greg, we are just about out of time.
Okay.
The hour has gone by very quickly, and it's been very fascinating, and it's been wonderful to hear about your work. And I want to thank you for taking the time to be on Radio In Vivo today.
Well, thank you, Ernie. It's been a pleasure.
And next week on Radio In Vivo, my very special guest will be Dr. Philip Carter, who is Executive Director of Sigma Xi, the very prestigious scientific research society that has its world headquarters right here in the Research Triangle. We will learn all about this very impressive organization, and we will hear about the work they've been doing recently, along with the United Nations Foundation, in preparing a landmark report on climate change and sustainable development. I'm Ernie Hood, and this is Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And please remember, if you enjoy the program and the many other terrific shows here on WCOM, we hope you will make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.